Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, the Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today we ask, will Theresa May survive the year and does it matter? One sign that a ship might be about to sink would be that the rats on board make a run for it. The phrase is believed to have originated with Pliny the Elder, a Roman historian, philosopher, naturalist, and military leader. Pliny died while attempting a rescue mission during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD. The volcano had already obliterated the towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum, and Pliny's friends in a nearby town feared they would be next, so he took a ship and raced across the Bay of Naples to save them. He succeeded, but died in the process, the heat and smoke of Vesuvius overcoming him in the end. 2 years before his death, Pliny the Elder authored one of the first written records of a phrase in common use today. In his 77 AD book, Natural History, he wrote, "When a building is about to fall down, all the mice desert it." Over the centuries, the building became a ship, and the mice became rats. Perhaps as cinders and pumice fell on Pliny the Elder's ship as it crossed the Bay of Naples, the rats beat a hasty retreat too. Today, the phrase rats fleeing a sinking ship is near universal, and certainly a fitting description of what's happening to the Conservative government of Theresa May. So in this week's podcast, we'll be taking a look at the various fires engulfing the Conservative Party and the May government. Walking us through the stories will be the Canary's weekend editor, Tracy Keeling, alongside journalists Steve Topple and Freya Lockley. Welcome, team.
Hiya.
Hello.
Hello.
Steve, let's start with you. There's been a resignation. What happened?
This was absolutely delicious. Okay, so I could have eaten it all up, Kerri-Anne. Okay. Sorry, it was a sensible head. Hang on. Right. And we have a man called Peter Reynolds. Peter Reynolds is a former journalist who used to write a weekly column for The Independent. And he also is in charge of a campaign group called Clear Cannabis Reform. He also was previously a PR director for the delightful Saatchi & Saatchi. And he went rather publicly this week in resigning from the Conservative Party. Now, this was no ordinary resignation. This was a tour de force of scathing criticism that was levelled upon Theresa May. It was quite extraordinary in its content, actually. What I'll do, I'll just read a little bit of what he said to you, and then we can go from there. So he started off by saying, "After the disastrous handling of the EU referendum results, the ludicrous decision to appoint one of the most incompetent and out-of-touch prime ministers, and her farcical election performance, I have been wrestling for some time as to whether to renew my membership." He continued, he went on to call May, he said she was an authoritarian bigot with no mandate and no respect. He was critical of the cabinet, and he also poured scorn upon the way that the cabinet and the prime minister are dealing with Brexit, saying they have failed entirely to plan for a leave vote and they have dithered, waffled, dodged and tripped up again and again, achieving absolutely nothing in the period since the result.
Why?
He concluded that May wrecked Brexit, damaged Britain irreparably in the process, and he said, quote, "If I had my way, Mrs. May would be led in chains out of Downing Street and placed in stocks in Parliament Square to endure the humiliation she so richly deserved." Now, I mean, we all have some sort of turns of phrases we'd like to level at Theresa May. This is quite severe. The thing with this guy, this Peter Reynolds, the thing to bear in mind with him is, firstly, he's quite a traditional Tory in the sense of that he's fairly socially liberal, obviously chairing the Clear Cannabis Reform Board, and it makes him that. But he's also quite economically libertarian. He is pro-Brexit in every sense of the word, and wants a hard Brexit and does believe this sort of pandering that Theresa May is doing at the minute to the EU, that all, well, we might have this, we might not have that. He's not for that. He's very hard Brexit. But what was interesting about it, what it does, it very much underscores what is going on in the Conservative Party more broadly at the minute. Mm. So that You have the divisions between the Eurosceptic MPs and the pro-EU MPs are really coming to the fore. I mean, you had, I think it was Anna Salisbury, didn't she, came out this week saying that Theresa May isn't even aware that there are plots and plans going on behind the scenes with the pro-EU Tory MPs and that Theresa May needs to get a handle on this. You had David Davis issuing a warning saying that people need to get behind Brexit or get Jeremy Corbyn. And this resignation from Reynolds and the sort of furore that's encompassed it, if you like, it kind of sums up those tensions, I think. It summed it up very neatly.
Wow. I mean, very interesting that it would be coming from the kind of the pro-hard Brexit camp as well. I mean, there's, you know, as you say, there's you know, it's difficult to see how May's going to navigate her way out of this one because, you know, the kind of Brexit that Theresa May is already promoting is a harder Brexit than, you know, most of the country seem to want, judging by the latest opinion polls, and yet not hard enough. But simultaneously, he's calling her an authoritarian bigot.
Yeah, I think, again, it kind of plays into the kind of Tory he is. So you can tell by the way he writes. Yeah, so Reynolds linked in another piece to his feelings on Brexit more broadly. He proclaimed, he said, "Where is the Tory alternative? There is great excitement, belief and enthusiasm for Brexit. 17.4 million people voted for it. Where is the Conservative spokesperson passionately declaiming this?" So that kind of underscores his stance on it. But I agree. I mean, to a lot of people, Theresa May is going quite hard with Brexit, but I don't think it's enough for some people in the party. And I think it's going to cause major problems for her in the coming weeks.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult to understand at this point. I mean, we've written, you know, several pieces on this. It almost feels like pretty much any contender for May's position has already decided that the last thing that they want to do is kind of have their hands on the steering wheel while this juggernaut goes over the Brexit cliff. You know, you've got the kind of the time bombs laid by 7 years of austerity all kind of blowing up on Theresa May's watch. And simultaneously, this kind of diplomatic embarrassment of Brexit, where pretty much it seems like every single individual person in her party and in the country has an entirely unique perspective on what Brexit they want to see. So there don't even seem to be any kind of collective, you know, groups which would be happy if she went one way or the other, or even if Jeremy Corbyn went one way or the other. But it seems like she's a dead man walking. And the only reason that she's kind of continuing to hobble on is that nobody else really wants a sip of the poison chalice right now.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, look, in another world and in another lifetime, I would probably feel a bit of sympathy for Theresa May. Because as you quite rightly alluded to, she is now at the end game of 7 years of austerity when it's all unravelling. And of course, although she wasn't cabinet during that period, she wasn't directly responsible for the particular decisions surrounding public sector budget cuts. She's seeing the end of that. She was left with the result of an EU referendum, which many people didn't want or felt was needed. And let's not forget, she was pro-EU. She was a Remainer. And so she's been left with the carcass of that by Cameron and Osborne and co. Again, you quite rightly pointed out, Brexit is a very individual thing. This is what was so preposterous in some respects about the referendum. There was no yes or no answer to this. It was a question that we shouldn't have really been asked, in my opinion, because everyone's interpretation is so different. And she is now having to deal with the fallout of that with probably the worst party to deal with over Brexit, because opinions are so polarised in the Conservatives. So I don't think anyone, as you say, wants to be in her shoes. And it'd be interesting to see how long she does last, because no bugger will probably want to pick up the job.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Paul Mason writing a piece just kind of prior to the referendum, you know, arguing that you can't have a yes or no referendum about this. And to some degree, the result of the referendum is illegitimate without a second referendum following it, or at least a general election following it, so that you could have each party campaigning for, you know, this is what Brexit looks, our Brexit looks like. This is what our Remain looks like, you know, and people could have cast their vote knowing that within 6 months of that vote, the government would be, you know, in place to deliver on those wishes. And it's, you know, I'm with you. I kind of feel like without having some democratic say over the how of Brexit, I really don't understand how this is some great exercise of democracy. I find it even more hilarious, actually, that those who most adamantly favoured Brexit in the, you know, continuing to use this phrase, the will of the people must be enforced. Well, the will of the people in terms of what Brexit we have was never expressed, never given the opportunity of expression. And those people who are all pro-will of the people seem to be very anti-will of the people when it comes to holding, you know, a second vote or having some further democratic intervention in the process. So thank you for that, Steve. We're going to just quickly pop over to Freya now, because this revolt with this sort of one resignation letter, I mean, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop with one disgruntled Conservative, does it? Your story, Freya, actually captures the wider crisis for May. So could you fill us in on that?
Yeah, so on the same day that the resignation was made, the right-wing press went to town on Theresa May. It came on the back of her announcing to ITV that she was in it for the long haul. I think what's most surprising about this is that the criticism hasn't come from the left-wing press. It's come from those that you'd normally think would support the Tories.
Right.
And the Times in particular has absolutely gone to town on her. And I think it's fair to say there's the Tories are leaking so far, the ceiling looks like it's about to come in anytime soon, because there's a lot of people talking a lot of stuff about at the moment. Someone leaking, don't know who, said to the Times, I think she's just signed her own death warrant. She lost our majority in an election. She didn't have to and shot.
Wow.
Quite strong and quite strong words, especially to see in the Times.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, it wasn't that long ago that the Times was offering Theresa May a column. You remember that?
Yeah.
And she was all like, I love the Times. The Times is my paper. And it's just shafting her now.
And the knives are out. And this was on the back, of course, of last week, the Times went for Boris Johnson. Mm. And it seems like a lot of Tories are saying a lot of things to the press.
Yeah.
And also to back this up, Conservative Home, which conducts polls amongst Tories, said that over 50% want her to resign as party leader. But it still leaves the question, does anybody else want to step into her shoes?
Absolutely. And I mean, as we've already touched so far, it doesn't look like anyone's particularly champing at the bit to take over the party at this point, because I mean, there is the whiff of decay about the Conservative Party at the moment. But you know, it's kind of starting almost to remind me of the sort of Ian Duncan Smith, William Hague, Michael Howard era, you know, of the Conservative Party, where it just sort of felt like a game of musical chairs where no one really wanted the seat because it had a leg missing and was about to, you know, crumble underneath them.
Are we allowed to say rot?
We certainly are allowed to say.
It's gone decay now.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite stinky. Also interesting, the point you make about the press as well. I've been thinking about this, you know, quite often, you know, the Times, the Telegraph, the Financial Times, you know, these are papers that, you know, generally are conservative leaning papers, but they're also pro-business. And I'm starting to wonder if maybe the issue of the impact of Brexit on some of the kind of businesses that support the Telegraph, the Times and, you know, these others is going to create quite the conflict of interest. And it looks like business might be winning at the moment.
It looks that way. And I can't help but remember as well that, remember the showdown between Gove and Boris Johnson last year after the referendum?
Yeah.
And Gove's wife, Sarah Vine, used to work at the Times.
Mm.
And I do wonder, with the Murdoch-led press, what might be going on behind the scenes, given the fact that, I think it's a really good point about business, and yeah, that they all seem to be rounding in on Theresa May.
Yeah, it's really quite interesting to have the sort of the right-wing tabloids, you know, The Sun, The Daily Mail, The Express, you know, these very pro-Brexit, fairly xenophobic kind of outlets, almost square. I mean, it could get to the point when I was squaring off with two sectors of the Conservative press, you know, the broadsheets on the one hand, you know, who are kind of commercially minded, generally kind of, you know, EU sceptic at a push, but mostly kind of EU sceptic remainers, versus the sort of, you know, tabloid right, who are absolutely pro the hardest possible Brexit that May could deliver. It's going to be interesting couple of years. At the moment, I mean, it's really difficult. It's one of those things where, you know, you can almost see two. I mean, there's so many possibilities. You could always imagine her like somehow hanging on until 2022, the next general election, or she could be gone tomorrow. It's just really unclear as to, it almost seems to be, you know, her life expectancy is purely based on her party's willingness to get rid of her now.
Yeah, and it looks increasingly like the 1922 committee are not behind her in any way, shape or form.
Wow.
So, and as to the leadership contest, obviously there's been a lot of talk about everybody's favourite Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Oh, God, yeah.
I don't know whether that's a possibility or not, but again, the press seem to be putting their money behind him at the moment as well, which is even more surprising.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell whether this is genuine or if it's a product of silly season, where they, you know, they build him up and then already now they're knocking him down again by saying, oh, by the way, he's against abortion, even in cases where women have been raped by a family member. In all condition, there's no condition under which he would accept, you know, abortion. He's also anti-equal marriage. He voted against it. But it's the hypocrisy of it. So he's against abortion because of the protection of life. And he was wanting to vote against the, you know, the Human Rights Act. he's voted against, you know, supporting child refugees coming to Britain to be saved from conflict. So it seems like Jacob Rees-Mogg only kind of cares about life while it's in the womb. From the moment you're born, Jacob Rees-Mogg couldn't give two hoots about you.
And I wonder why they let him out of the box this week as well.
Goodness only knows. I mean, obviously, we know from our newsroom that, you know, after the sort of foray of the general election died down, we entered silly season and it was just, you know, the most painful news cycle to be a part of, you know, and kind of we passed the time by kind of picking up kind of the original investigative stories and things that we sort of left by the wayside while we were busy, you know, doing all of the election coverage. But it seems like the majority of Fleet Street were sort of preoccupied with cat gifts and Jacob Rees-Mogg election campaigns. Really, really, really strange, but interesting to see where that goes. I think, yeah, as you say, there's a lot more to watch as this thing unfolds. So we should probably grab popcorn and make ourselves comfortable. Thanks, Freya. And of course, May's problems don't finish with internal dissent. After 7 years of Tory austerity, it's getting harder to bury the bodies. Tracy, you've been reporting on a particularly disastrous impact of austerity this week. What happened?
Yeah. So what happened is that we got concrete proof, essentially, that austerity is failing, that it is just codswallop that does not work. Mm. Obviously, one of the Tory mantras is that the reason for austerity is that we need to live within our means as a country, services, people. But what we found out this week, or at the end of last week, is that services, and people are not living within their means, but other parts of society, so other services in this instance, are picking up the slack. So yeah, when one service is collapsing, another service is bearing the brunt of that. And in particular, we found out that the police service is picking up the slack from the mental health service failing. So yeah. Shadow Police Minister Louise Hague sent an Freedom of Information request to find out how many cases of mental health the police are dealing with on a general basis. And she found that the police last year alone received 115,000 calls where somebody was concerned about someone's mental health. And that equals one call every 5 minutes. So
whoa.
Every 5 minutes, the police service is dealing with a mental health issue, which is, of course, not their main remit as a service. And that's a third higher, by the way, than what it was in 2011, 2012. So when the Tories first came in their early years, it's now grown by a third in terms of the amount of calls that the police service are receiving. And The Guardian covered the story, by the way, and they spoke to the College of Policing's mental health coordinator, Michael Brown. And Michael was very clear about why this is happening, where this is coming from. Two major reasons, one being that there is an increasing need for mental health provision, for increasing amount of mental health issues coming up. And secondly, that the cuts are making this occur, that the cuts are having an impact. And as we regularly talk about at the Canary, there have been whopping cuts in mental health. So between 2010 and 2015, mental health trusts lost the equivalent of almost £600 million a year, every year. So those cuts and the fact that there are more cases of it, I guess, are the two reasons why the police are now having to deal with masses of mental health situations rather than just the NHS, rather than just the health service. But the police themselves, of course, have also faced austerity cuts. So we now have 20,000 less officers than we had when the Tories came into power. So they're a reduced service in that way because of austerity, but they're having to take up the mental health work because the Mental Health Trust can't do it because of austerity.
This is just such a complete mess, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, I've literally lost count of how many articles now we've written about various elements of this, you know, kind of the lead up. It's not like this suddenly happened. You know, this has been being warned about, being signposted, you know, accelerating in scale throughout the 7 years of austerity. But Steve, was it you? Have you written on this, Steve, in the past?
Yeah, loads. There's another one. These subjects I've kept banging on about, and yet we still hear more horror stories as the weeks pass, as it were.
Absolutely, because I mean, I think you've made really strong points here, Tracy, about the fact that, you know, it's almost threefold, this issue, because on the one hand, you have ideological austerity itself creating and exacerbating mental illness in people. You know, we had the report not that long ago that it had, I think it was about 500 suicides that had been linked directly to austerity. I know James Wright had covered the issue of, I think it was about, oh God, I'm going to struggle with the numbers.
It was five. Carry on. It was 579 suicides and over 250,000 additional cases.
Brilliant. Thank you, Steve. And then austerity itself cutting the funding for the very, you know, institutions and organisations that would be supporting people dealing with crises of mental health. Then that means that the burden for that responsibility shifts to the police, where austerity has cut them by 20,000 as well. It's just constant. It's
ludicrous. And to pull it to the your discussion earlier, so, you know, we're asking, is May done for, you know, or, you know, will she last? And with this particular subject, whether she's done for or not, it continues because it's not exclusive to the leadership. It is that a party-wide religion that austerity is, you know, that every policy should be based around it, or, you know, everything in terms of provision, public provision. So whether she goes or not, that this stays. So it's the whole party, the whole government that needs reform if they are to stay, because bringing somebody else in isn't going to help at all.
Can I just chip in? I think there's one interesting point to make. Most of the austerity, if you like, came out pre-EU referendum, didn't it? So yep. We have the shrinking of the state, small state conservatives, which they traditionally are, and then, of course, we had the EU referendum. Now, Cameron and his cronies expected that to go their way and that we'd vote Remain. I think Brexit has been such a wild card that... It appears there are some mutterings now in the party whether actually this austerity is sustainable because of the public outcry in many quarters over Brexit, coupled with that, could really be the end for the Tories. I mean, you have rumours this week, the likes of Jeremy Hunt pressuring Theresa May to end the 1% public sector pay cap.
Yeah.
For example. So it might be that it's suddenly dawning on these people in the Tory party that a combination of austerity and Brexit might be too much for the public to stomach now. So it's one to watch, and it's something I don't think they predicted was obviously going to happen.
Useful intervention, Steve. I also think you touch on an interesting distinction because they call themselves small state conservatives. But I mean, really, they're small welfare state conservatives. And by welfare state, we don't just mean job seek allowance. We mean the education system, the NHS, you know, the public transport. This is the whole, you know, the welfare state is as a concept includes all of those things. They're a small welfare state party, but they're quite happy to hand the state extraordinary powers when it's in their favour, you know, such as, you know, the Investigative Powers Act, you know, which is basically the Snoopers Charter. And unprecedented powers of surveillance to the government and their organisations. So they seem to be, you know, small state only when it seems to be cutting support for poorer people.
I mean, what they are, Kerri-Anne, is essentially are corporatists in every sense of the word. Naomi Klein described in the Shock Doctrine that corporatists are small state when it comes to public services, but they are big government when it comes to surveillance and the handing out of public contracts to private contractors. So they are, in essence, they are the perfect corporatists, if you like, of the 21st century.
So these things aren't separate. Austerity and corporatism are, you know, completely linked.
Yeah.
Because in the name of austerity efficiency, those corporate companies get massive contracts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the services are less for us, but the money is going to these, you know, in the NHS, for example, to these hugely wealthy companies. So if they continue that ideology, that corporate ideology, then austerity is part and parcel of that. It's useful to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the analogy that we've used before is it's, you know, the Tories are taking things that we built and own collectively, you know, selling them to their mates at bargain basement prices, and then we're having to rent them back for sky high prices, you know, and all in the name of fiscal responsibility. I mean, it's just a joke. It's beyond a joke. Yeah. It's clear enough that sort of in the financial services community, everyone there knows what austerity means. It doesn't mean tightening the belts. It doesn't mean fiscal responsibility. It means reorienting the economy to suit the financial services industry, essentially reorienting the economy to service debt. Debt that was never incurred by the people who are now responsible for paying it, which is exactly what happened. If you follow the anatomy of disaster of the financial crisis, exactly what happened.
So we just discussed that it, you know, it does help these corporate businesses, which are donors of the Tory party, and then of course many politicians will go and work in that through that revolving door in these companies eventually. But it also, because for some reason this idea of fiscal responsibility is now something that the public have swallowed as a priority. That if our government is responsible with money, therefore they are electable. It's what they use as an attack against Labour constantly, the Conservative Party. So actually, like, austerity does benefit these corporate companies, but it also benefits the Tories because it keeps getting them re-elected.
Yeah.
By keep saying, we're responsible. So there is something in it for them as well.
You know, what's so frustrating is because the bulk of the media is conservative, the bulk of the media is absolutely behind those policies. What should be happening now is, you know, this you know, this mental health crisis should be on the front page of every newspaper in the country. Theresa May should be under enormous pressure to change direction, and instead, barely reported. You know, you've got to look around for it. It's just, you know, and I think that's what's worrying. I mean, that ties into, you know, the stuff that we do here with trying to create a new media, you know, which actually does its job as the fourth estate, rather than serving really as just a propaganda arm of the sort of the neoliberal establishment, which is basically what we've got now. Okay. Thank you, Tracy. Another gleeful story to uplift our listeners. We're going to finish on another disaster. That actually, I mean, this one really does, in all seriousness, threaten to dwarf the issues that we've discussed so far today, and even historic disasters like I was talking about earlier on with the destruction of Pompeii. Freya, you've been keeping an eye on the escalating tensions between the US and North Korea for us. What on earth is going on?
So on Sunday, North Korea launched its sixth and biggest nuclear test. And according to most information, it looks like this time they did actually launch a hydrogen bomb.
Yeah.
So in response to this, the new UN called an emergency meeting, in which some very strong words were said, pretty much leading to the fact that this was enough was enough. The UN is proposing even stronger sanctions against North Korea. And there's been talk even of trying to halt the oil supply going into North Korea, thinking that it might need to go that far to actually sort of have a bigger effect on North Korea and to stop what's going on with the missiles continual launching, which obviously isn't being helped by Trump's tweets backwards and forwards, threatening fire, fury and everything else.
Well, it wasn't even just Trump, was it? It was a US Secretary of Defense, you know, coming out and saying, well, you know, we're not saying we're going to go for the total annihilation of North Korea, but it's on the table.
It was US Ambassador Nikki Haley her outline of attempts and the way they were going to limit North Korea's use of nuclear weapons was the strongest it has been so far, saying that enough is enough, completely ignoring the fact that if North Korea has about 10 nuclear weapons, but the USA has around 6,800.
Wow.
But anyway, Nikki Haley laid down the line and said that only the strongest sanctions will enable us to resolve this problem. So the UN are calling for very strong sanctions, which in itself isn't very simple. Donald Trump has come out in all of this and said that in addition to these other options, he should stop trade with any country doing business with North Korea, which on one hand, but I'll come back to that later, sounds quite simple, but it turns out the web behind that is incredibly murky.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest trading partners of North Korea is China. But they have suggested that sanctions aren't easy because it would affect them. But they are also America's largest trading partner. And trade between the US and China is worth $648.2 billion.
Absolutely. Well, China also bought up a whole stack of US debt not long ago, if we remember precisely, I think, to get further leverage.
And the talk is at the moment that if sanctions were pushed, actually the impact on the world's economic stage is going to be catastrophic, never mind the bombs, because of the amount of money owed between China and the US.
Yeah.
So that's one whole direction. And if we throw in stopping oil to North Korea, there's another direction. And then Vladimir Putin waded in as well.
Yeah.
So kind of this week, we've seen all the big players moving onto the stage. Putin said that sanctions would be useless and ineffective and suggested that there's absolutely no way North Korea would give up the nuclear weapons. According to Putin, they'd rather eat grass than abandon their nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, well, he's right. I mean, I don't agree with Putin on much, but he's pretty much spot on that one.
yeah, the, you know, the talk from the big players is about that we can solve this not through diplomacy but through sanctions. We'll cut off an already isolated country, make them even more isolated, and in the hope that that's going to stop the testing. So yeah, I think for once Putin was actually right. But what this has also thrown up is the whole issue of where North Korea is actually getting the money from to mm-hmm. continue its program of nuclear protection.
Yeah, this was the sorry punchline of your piece on the matter, wasn't it?
Yeah, and so it turns out that North Korea actually sold arms to the United Arab Emirates. They raised $100 million worth that went directly into funding the North Korean missile program.
Yeah.
Where this gets even more heartbreaking is that the UAE used the bombs that they bought to continue the hideous war in Yemen. So the threads behind this story sort of touch, I think, to the heart of quite what the extent that war has got to in 2017.
I think you're absolutely right. I think also the sort of the interconnectedness of these seemingly separate issues, you know, from Yemen to the arms industry to the efficacy of sanctions, you know, to all of the essentially every significant player on the world stage right now involved is feeling eerily like the Balkans in the early 20th century, isn't it? You know, this kind of bizarre nature of alliances and commercial relationships kind of basically propelling people into war that seemingly nobody actually wants, and yet everybody seems to be making more likely with every statement that they make in public.
Yeah, and also that billions of pounds and dollars are being raised through the sale of arms.
Yeah.
And this whole situation that's emerged now is masking the fact, you know, the billions of pounds that are going on behind that. As a result of this, America stands to make billions more dollars by arming South Korea and Japan. So that it doesn't stop there.
Yeah.
So, and it just goes on and on and on. And it turns out that there's even more behind this story, because the UAE, who are closely aligned with Saudi Arabia, tried to hide. It suggested that the UAE government knew exactly about this arms deal, that they were actually buying arms from North Korea, despite the international veto on anybody buying arms from North Korea,
yeah.
And that they were burying that through huge business interests. And one of those is, it's called the International Golden Group. And despite trying to bury it, the International Golden Group are going to be present in the UK, in London, at an arms fair going on next week, selling arms to people in the rest of the world. So it wow. comes right back to our very doorstep and, you know, right back to home, this one. It might look like it's out there, but actually...
Absolutely. And it's, I mean, isn't this the joke of all this? You know, it's that... You know, they're literally willing to take us to the brink of war over these issues, but simultaneously happy to profit from them.
Yeah, and we're not talking small profits. We're talking billions and billions of pounds.
Yeah.
And the fact that most Western governments seem to be protecting the interests of other Western governments as these huge arms sales go on all yeah. around the world. Apparently there are sanctions, but they don't seem to apply to people buying bombs from each other and using them to bomb countries like Yemen.
Absolutely. I find it astonishing as well. It's obviously, you know, you've got Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn says, you know, I'm not in favour of renewing Trident on, you know, our nuclear missiles. And basically the whole country, you know, about a decent chunk of the country was saying, you're a lunatic. You've got to have nuclear yeah. weapons, our only defence. And then you have North Korea, which, you know, let's not joke about it. No one wants to live in North Korea, particularly. It's, you know, you've got a dictatorship run by a man not only with an abysmal haircut, but who also, you know, believes he's, you know, from God. But then so does the Queen, I suppose. Anyway, you know, you've got this horrible, repressive, you know, dictatorship happening there. But that's not the fault of all of the people in North Korea. You know, that that's the fault of the dictatorship that governs them. So you have to separate that. And if you were sitting in North Korea, you've seen the US or the West obliterate, you know, two cities in Japan. You've seen them ever since, you know, build up a stockpile of nuclear weapons that could easily obliterate humanity and everything else on the earth, full stop. You've been battered with sanctions. You've got repeated military drills happening right on your border. Wouldn't you want to develop a nuclear?
I think it's highly likely.
You know,
I think if I can just interrupt, I think, Kerri-Anne, that's spot on. But that's what, when they talk about sanctions towards North Korea, that's what all these politicians, whether they realise it or not, they don't actually acknowledge the fact that the Kim Jong-un's whole regime and his father before him and his grandfather before that, their regime is built on fear of the outside world and fear that all these other countries have nuclear weapons. And that's how they maintain control. And that was, it goes back to what you said earlier, quoting Putin, saying they'd rather eat grass. They would rather eat grass, because
a lot of them are eating grass, aren't they? I mean,
exactly.
You know, like, according to North Korea, sanctions will actually affect the people there who are already living under a dictatorship, and some of them are eating grass already.
Another thing to mention is that when we're talking about sanctions, we understand the impact of what happens when the UN carries out severe sanctions on a country. We only have to look to Iraq in the 90s to see what happened there. It resulted in, depending on the estimates you look at, hundreds of thousands and more deaths and malnutrition, because when the whole world and the states of a whole world sanction, it does affect the basic supplies of the people in that particular country.
Absolutely.
That's different to sanctions on a, you know, a people level. So if you look at the BDS movement, for example, sanctions like that don't affect on such a large scale. They can be cultural, they can be, different, but
absolutely. Well, I mean, that's the difference. You know, if you have something like the BDS movement, which is Palestinian led, you know, targeting, you know, the state of Israel to apply pressure, that would hopefully have a positive outcome on the, you know, a current apartheid, you know, regime that Israel is running in the country. This is something that's people led, and the targets are not people. They are, you know, organisations and institutions. You know, what you have when you have a kind of UN sanctions is literally, they stop food. I mean, it's closer to a siege. You know, if anyone's watching Game of Thrones, you know, people ride up the horses, surround the castle and don't let anything in or out. And they starve the people out of the castle. This is effectively what you know, our world Game of Thrones does as well, is that they surround a country, isolate it diplomatically, and they literally physically prevent, you know, staple items, food, fuel, construction materials, going into the country. These are two hugely, hugely different things. And again, another source of great hypocrisy, in that, you know, a carefully targeted institutional BDS movement against Israel is deemed as some sort of anti-democratic evil act. And yet starving an entire country is seen as good diplomacy. You know, that's what frustrates me about the reporting on this so much, is it's almost as if literally this whole issue with North Korea started with North Korea trying to get a nuclear bomb. There seems to be no acceptance of kind of
the American presence in South Korea.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that point of partition, that nobody seems to discuss that in the whole lead up to this situation.
What's so frustrating about this situation as well is that you can't, if you really want to resolve it, like if you're actually acting in good faith, and what you would like to see is an armistice between North Korea and the United States, which works with both sides, you know, pulling back, you know, maybe, you know, a different scenario in North Korea, so we could, you know, have some solidarity with the people of North Korea and any democratic ambitions that they might have. And in order to do that, you have to analyse the root causes of these things. And I think what's annoying is that if you even attempt to kind of present an accurate, complete history of what's happened with North Korea, you're sort of denounced as a pro-Kim Jong-un fanatic, you know, or a Putinist or something. It's just that kind of become, there's such a stigma around simply honouring the truth of history now.
Yeah, and there's also, there's reports emerging that apparently North Korea is considering the possibility of taking a diplomatic route, but the press in America are not reporting that. And so it looks like any tentative steps towards bringing this to the table for discussion is being completely swamped by the Western media and building them up as this gung-ho, warmongering nation.
Yeah.
And that any sort of tentative steps towards making peace may be completely shouted out.
Yeah. So, guys, I think I'll open this up. I'll begin with Freya, because I think it's really interesting. For, you know, each of us probably has a different take on this. But, you know, what's going to happen here? What are the potential outcomes of this situation?
I mean, each time we get to this point, there is talk that we are on the brink of a nuclear catastrophe, which I think is causing an incredible amount of fear, which in turn is probably playing into this idea of punish North Korea.
Yeah.
And yet the situation is incredibly complex. I think on one side of that, we at this point, we have to hope that some kind of sense will prevail. And yet we're looking ultimately at a standoff between a 71-year-old reality TV star and a 31-year-old dictator. So I think one of the big problems is we're in a new place because that standoff is incredibly unpredictable. And Trump has his hand on the nuclear button, so I don't want to look into worst scenario. I'm hoping that this level of brinkmanship can actually be eased off by people standing up and going, hang on, you know, we are right on the brink of things. But there is talk as well that, you know, possibly we could go over the brink almost by mistake.
Yeah.
You know, that it could be just one false step where either North Korea or America misread the steps of the other. Apparently, one of the things that Kim Jong-un is sort of most worried about is a Gaddafi kind of situation, that he is seen to be weak in front of the whole country. And I don't think there's a simple answer. The other thing at the moment is it's very much looking as though as they amass troops and more weapons in both Japan and South Korea, could that possibly lead to a mistake? The North Korean army is far bigger. I mean, if we are talking about any kind of land invasions, that they do have an incredibly huge army and armed force. Yeah. So I don't think there's an easy answer to this. I think there's lots of possibilities and lots of steps that could be taken. And overall, I guess we've got to hope that some kind of sense is going to prevail and peace, because this wouldn't be a war like we've seen in Iran or Iraq or Afghanistan.
Yeah.
This takes things to a completely different place and different level.
And as we've pointed to already, just so many key actors on the world stage involved. You know, there are so many alliances here that would have to be honoured. It's difficult to think how you could get out of a war if it kicked off.
And how the interconnectivity between those alliances, you know, it's not even a simple, right, we know we've got two sides like we did in the Cold War.
Yeah.
The threads in this are so complicated and interconnected between the different countries, between Russia, China and the US alone. That is not a simple one to unravel, not least because of the billions of dollars, you know, invested in different ways between those three countries.
Absolutely. And again, you know, another proxy war potentially between the same nations. You know, we already have Syria on fire and the same players are all involved in Syria, you know, fighting a proxy war in which there are no good guys. You know, and devastating an entire country. And, you know, it Yeah, there is something achingly Cold War about all of this.
And yet there is no good. It's not a, like, this is the good side, this is the bad side, which was how the Cold War was always played out, wasn't it, with those, that sort of polemic between the two.
Yeah. But there's no goodies.
Just throw NATO into the mix of all of that, and it's even more complicated.
Okay, thanks. Thank you for that, Freya. Does anyone else want to chip in?
Well, just, you know, to really leave people smiling, seeing as that's our way. So, you know, when we're talking NATO, then one of NATO rules is if one member state is under attack, every member state has to come to their aid. So if Trump recklessly does decide to, you know, start something, or North Korea does, we're in that. The UK is in that. Because you don't think for 1 second Theresa May is going to say, I'm not quite sure whether we should join this nuclear war. You know, that's the rules of NATO.
I personally, just to put my two pennies worth in, I'm personally sceptical when anyone mentions nuclear war, I'm afraid. I've done too much digging into just who finances who, and while I think the idea of a proxy war in, if you like, normal terms is likely, I'm highly sceptical of anything nuclear. For me, there's too much money involved. It would be unprofitable, especially when you mention the relationship trade-wise between the US and China.
Yeah.
And you only have to look at the stock markets, to be honest, because while there's been blips over the past couple of months, the Dow Jones, for example, is up 2,000 points in a year. So they can't be that spooked.
Are we actually saying corporatism to the rescue, Steve?
We're saying corporatism is laughing its head off at us all being lulled into a state of fear over nuclear war, but anyway.
And meanwhile, they'll keep selling bombs to each other and keep push the prices up further.
Selling lots of ice cream to us while we're stressed out stuffing our faces comfort eating. It's a win-win for the corporations and all of this.
Exactly, they love it.
All right, well, somehow we've managed to turn nuclear holocaust into comedy. I don't know quite how we did that, but obviously...
Sorry, that's my bad.
So guys, if people want to actually find a way to do something about the stories that they've heard today, what can they do for it on potential nuclear holocaust?
Okay. Between the 12th and 15th of September, the Defence Security Equipment International, also known as DICEY, are going to be at the Excel Centre in London with one of the world's biggest arms fairs. Ahead of that, there is a week of action organised by people like Stop the Arms Fair and Campaign Against the Arms Trade to actually stop this exhibition happening. They've been blockading all week, and it's ongoing. It started on Monday up until the 9th of September, which is the big day of action. So in this instance, there actually is something you could do. Get down to London to the Excel Centre and help to stop the arms trade, which is one of the underpinning issues in this whole big mess.
Absolutely. Brilliant, Freya. And we'll leave details for that in the show notes on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. And also go to the Canary website, because we're covering this extensively. We've been covering it this week. We'll be covering it next week. We've got journalists on the ground there reporting on things as they happen. So you can get involved directly. You can support the journalism that's promoting those values. Those are two tangible things that you can do. Thanks, Freya. Tracy and Steve, what can people do about the issues with mental health, austerity?
So... there are numerous campaign groups that you can get involved with who will be staging protests or taking action against austerity, and also for the NHS, of course, campaign groups. So the People's Assembly would be a good one as an anti-austerity group to get involved with, and Keep Our NHS Public would be a good one for the NHS and the mental health services that we desperately need. Also, talk to people about what's going on as often as possible. The topic of this podcast is Will May Stay, who knows what that could trigger? Who knows when the next election is coming around?
Yeah.
So make sure people are aware of what impact these policies are having on their society, on the world around them.
Absolutely. I agree. So much of this comes down simply to just having conversations, doesn't it? Actually changing opinion that way, letting people that you love know what's going on. Thank you, Tracy. Steve, did you have anything to add on how people can get involved?
Yep. There's two great grassroots trade union organisations which I always support. One is the community membership branch of Unite the Community. They're open to people who are unemployed, people who receive welfare, people who might not normally be able to join the trade union. They're excellent. If you go to unitetheunion.org and search for community membership, you can get involved with them. And then also there's my mates at United Voices of the World Union, UVW Union, yep. Another fantastic union. They target employers which the big unions really don't want to deal with, and they deal with some of the most unscrupulous employers going, and they do excellent on the ground direct action, and they are at uvwunion.org.uk.
Brilliant. And before we go, the title of today's podcast was Will Theresa May Survive the Year and Does It Matter? So, quick straw poll. Will Theresa May survive the year? Steve?
Yes.
Tracy?
Yes.
Freya?
I hope not.
Oh, come on.
I'm sorry. I'm going Team Freya on this. I hope not. It awaits to be seen. And does it matter? Yes. I don't think any of us is expecting imminent nuclear war in North Korea, are we?
No.
Hopefully not.
I hope not.
Okay, thanks for joining me today, Steve, Freya and Tracy. That's us done for another week at Canary Pod. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter and use the hashtag Canary Pod to carry on the discussion. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.
Great excitement, belief and enthusiasm for breakfast.
For breakfast. 17 points.